Welcome to Keeping Up with the Constitution.
Today I'm here with Ms. Ludna from Asylum Access Malaysia, and on behalf of the M Constitution, we'd like to thank you once again for being a part of our constitutional podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so Ms. Ludna, you work for Asylum Access Malaysia. So you clearly work with refugees, as highlighted in the website for Asylum Access. So what exactly is the difference between an expat, an immigrant, a migrant, and a refugee?
I'll go with the similarities. All of them are obviously non-Malaysians. And that's quite a long list. And usually the first question that people usually ask is, what's the difference between a migrant and a refugee? I won't go into what each of them mean, because I think there's always been a bit of discussion about, oh, what's the difference between a migrant and an expat? I will tell you what a refugee is, however. So a refugee has a very specific definition that, and under international law, it's guided by the definition that is set out in the in an international legal document known as the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees. And that's a legal definition. And it is essentially, I will simplify it, it's essentially an individual who is outside of their country of origin and owing to a well-founded fear of persecution, either on the basis of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, membership of a social group. So there's specific grounds, are unable or unwilling to return to their country of origin. So it is very specific. There are a number of elements in that definition, but I think it really does boil down to the ability to return to their country of origin. I mentioned the similarities between all the categories that you've mentioned, which was, I think, expat, immigrant, migrant, and refugee. I don't know if I've missed out anything, but just in terms of what sets out a refugee from all those categories is that a refugee does not actually have the luxury to be able, or choice really, to be able to return home because of specific reasons.
So in short, why do refugees exist?
Why do they exist, in what sense? I would ask back, why do they exist? Is that nobody chooses to be a refugee. Nobody asks to be a refugee. And why do they exist is because of circumstances that force them into a situation where they need to seek refuge or safety or shelter in another country, in a country that's not their home. And so it might be a number of, it may be many, many different reasons. No two refugees have the exact same story. So if you ask, why do refugees exist? That really is, you know, it can be a philosophical question. And I think it really does boil down to the cause. If you look at the different situations that refugees, that different individuals face, that forces them to take on this, I would say position, I suppose, as a refugee, unwillingly, and it can be war, it can be conflict, and I mentioned the word persecution, which is a specific word that's actually enumerated in the 51 Convention, and persecution, not just general persecution, but based on specific grounds, that's also enumerated in the Convention. So why do refugees exist? It's a very broad question. Nobody chooses to be a refugee, and it really is owing to circumstances beyond their own control.
So I like how you mentioned the word persecution. So are refugees bad people?
Why? Persecution and not prosecution. So there is a specific difference between persecution and prosecution, and I think that's something that might be overlooked. I think the idea is that, you know, persecution, of course, has its own definition. It's very different from prosecution. And what's interesting is that persecution itself doesn't have a specific meaning. In order to just sort of illustrate it, it is when somebody is discriminated against to the extent that they are not able to live a safe and dignified life. And so, and we are talking about, you know, to the levels of where their lives may be in danger, where they may be tortured. And it's not mere simple discrimination. And of course, there are a number of states that, that may practice discriminatory policies, but it rise, you know, when we talk about situations that rise to the level of persecution, it is so serious that an individual is forced to leave their country of origin and not be able to return.
So what is the refugee climate like in Malaysia?
What is the refugee climate like in Malaysia? So I think it'll be helpful to just set out the refugee context. So I mentioned, I made reference to the 1951 convention earlier just now. So the 1951 convention and its 1967 protocol are both legal documents that not only define who a refugee is, but sets out the rights and obligations of states as well as refugees. And when it comes to Malaysia, we're not a signatory to those documents. And when we look at our domestic laws, we have no domestic framework, whether from a legal perspective or an administrative perspective. And what that means essentially is that if an individual were to seek safety in Malaysia, arrive on Malaysian shores, and wanted to seek protection and seek the status of a refugee, they wouldn't be able to do that under our existing laws. There are no laws in Malaysia that even mention the word refugee. And the implication of that is, I mentioned earlier that refugees are individuals who are unable to return home for various reasons, right? And because of that, obviously, if let's say if they're arriving on our shores and they don't arriving here in Malaysia, and they usually have a visa, and visas usually would have like a certain maximum amount of time before it then lapses, and then you'd need to leave. And so what that means is that they're not then able to convert that visa into a document that would recognize them as refugees. They're not able to apply to any authority for the issuance of documentation that would contain the word refugee. And so with the absence of the recognition of the term refugees, what that means is that you then have individuals who are categorized as what our laws use the label as illegal immigrants. It's unfortunate because at Asylum Access, and indeed any human rights affirming individual, we don't use the term illegal immigrants, or you know, nobody is illegal. That's really something that we stand by. And so the proper term would be undocumented persons. But the English translation of the Immigration Act, if actually if you were to take a glance at it, actually does use the term illegal immigrants. And so that's the reason for why I'm using this term. And so refugees are then lumped together and regarded as illegal immigrants under the laws of Malaysia, which places them at risk of being prosecuted on immigration-related offences and being deported as well. So that kind of like sets out the situation when it comes to refugees in Malaysia, or the climate when it comes to refugees in Malaysia. It is one that is devoid of safety or security. And we've not even spoken about other basic rights. We're just talking about the legal right to be able to remain safely in Malaysia.
So how does Asylum Access come in?
All right, so Asylum Access Malaysia, we are an organization who support forcibly displaced individuals and communities in order for them to be able to reclaim their rights, agency, and power. All right, so what that means really is that we employ there is the element of service provision, but we employ also legal empowerment approaches within the services that we provide, within the programs that we run, to ensure that the climate, as you referred earlier, is not just less hostile, but safe enough for refugees to be able to rebuild their lives, to be able to live safely, to move freely. That is really the end goal that we're seeking here. The end goal at the end of the day, when we talk about our vision, is to make human rights a reality for refugees. Refugees are individuals who, by no fault of their own, have found themselves in a situation of displacement. And they are now in a foreign country, you know, with a language that many don't understand, in a culture that many of them might find completely foreign to them, no matter how close geographically their own country of origin may be to Malaysia, and is in a situation where, is in a precarious situation where they may face the risk of being deported at any given moment. And so how are they protected from this? So I mentioned earlier that there's no legal framework or administrative framework, indeed, for refugees in Malaysia. And because of that, then the question might be, why is there a refugee population in Malaysia? And so the answer to that is we have the Office of the United Nations Commissioner for the, sorry, I'm butchering this, but we do have a UNHCR office, which is the UN Refugee Agency. And this is the agency that is responsible for refugees in Malaysia when it comes to their reception, their registration, the determination of their refugee claim, and then the issuance of documents. And so that's the only way that any individual who wishes to apply for refugee status is able to seek safety, which is through applying to the UNHCR in Malaysia. Usually, it's the primary responsibility of states to conduct this entire process. In Malaysia, again, as I mentioned earlier, there's no national asylum system. And so all those responsibilities have moved over to the UN Refugee Agency. And with that, with the documentation, an individual would be able to be protected at least from being prosecuted on immigration grounds and from facing that risk of being forcibly removed from Malaysia and being deported back to their country of origin. Now, the process in order to be able to apply for registration with the UNHCR, and then after that, undergoing the refugee status determination process, can be quite complex for any individual. And so part of our work, one of the programs that exists at Asylum Access Malaysia, is to help individuals to be able to navigate that process with the UNHCR. So there's currently, I think, more than 185,000 refugees and asylum seekers who are currently registered or recognized by the UNHCR at this moment in time. But there's a large number of individuals who are still awaiting for registration and who are still awaiting for who are still awaiting their turn to undergo the refugee status determination interview. I'm going to focus a little bit on the refugee status determination interview, and I'm going to kind of like call it by its acronym, RSD. So for RSD, because of how complex the process can be, at Asylum Access Malaysia, one of our critical services have been to assist individuals, our clients, to be able to navigate that process. And that's either through providing information, through providing individualized legal counseling to explain what the process looks like, what to expect. Essentially, what we're trying to do is to support the individual who is undergoing that process. Now, in certain instances, an individual may have their claim assessed by the UNHCR and then be rejected. So what that means is that UNHCR does not find that this individual meets the definition of a refugee under the convention. And in this kind of situation, that individual will have one chance at appealing that decision. And so that is quite time sensitive. There is a certain period that you need to write in an appeal to UNHCR. And that I feel is where really our services become absolutely essential. There are individuals who might be illiterate, who might not be able to really present their case in totality before the UNHCR for any given reason. It may be due to trauma, it may be due to memory issues, and again, this lack of familiarity with what UNHCR, you know, the kind of the way to be able to present their case to UNHCR fully. And so that's where the legal advisors on the legal services team will come in and help with preparing, with first assessing their case, and then providing, at the minimum, we would provide legal counseling for people to be able to write in their own appeal, because UNHCR accepts appeal applications from individuals. You don't have to go through a lawyer for this. But when it comes to individuals who just really need that additional assistance, then we would, with their consent, be their legal representatives, write into UNHCR, and then after that, prepare the legal arguments necessary to submit to UNHCR on behalf of our clients. So I am spending a bit of time really talking about this because Asylum Access Malaysia is really one of the, I do believe that it is the only NGO in Malaysia that provides this kind of service to our refugee clients. So that's one aspect. And I have to mention this service because this is really what Asylum Access Malaysia first started on when we provided legal aid. Now, our approach and what we do has changed quite significantly since then. Now, we got started in Malaysia in 2014, I believe. And then so when we first rolled out, there was really a lot of focus on RSD services. Over time, however, the team has grown and the work has grown as well. And so the programs that exist at Asylum Access Malaysia, I can maybe list them down as three main programs. One is legal services, within which I've just explained like one of the critical services that we provide, which is legal representation for our refugee clients before the UNHCR. Another aspect is, of course, more engagement with local laws. So we do have a number of clients who approach us who are not familiar with Malaysian laws, who are not familiar with what their rights are. If they're facing, let's say, a criminal charge, sometimes they will need the assistance of a lawyer for legal representation. We have been looking into doing more of this because it is an unmet legal need. But our ability to be able to meet that gap is quite limited, simply because we don't have enough volunteer lawyers who'd be able to provide this kind of support. So that's under legal services. I mentioned three programs in total. So the second one would be community outreach. Now, as the name would suggest, that's really a lot of community engagement. We have refugees from all sorts of countries here, which means different refugee communities. And the community outreach program is really focused on a lot of engagement with different communities, really looking at legal empowerment, education on their rights on various topics, and looking at really pushing for more refugee leadership. Now, the idea is that Asylum Access Malaysia is to play more of a facilitative role, and that community groups, refugee-led organizations, are the one who will be able to sort of like take over the helm and essentially, you know, move on the terms that they wish to. So rather than us coming in and saying like, this is how you should be operating, these are the issues that you should be focused on, that really should be a process that's community led and community driven. And so Asylum Access really plays more of like aims to play more of a facilitative role there. So the community outreach program is really interesting because of the various sub programs that exist within that overarching program. We have a work rights program, where we have staff members who really look at the issue of work rights. And what that means is, I spoke about how there's refugees in Malaysia have no legal status, and what that means is that they don't have any legal right to work. However, refugees are working in Malaysia. That's just a fact. Whether it's informally, whether it's at great personal risk, people have to eat. They have to put food on the table. They have to provide for their family members. There are people with children here. And so they work, and unfortunately, we receive a lot of reports of abuse or exploitation, unpaid wages, unfair dismissals. And so what the work rights program really looks at first, getting information out, providing legal education to communities, different communities, for them to understand what their rights are, even without the legal status to work. If labor has been provided and there's been an agreement that they would be compensated for it, that's actually no bar to refugees to be able to get back to claim their unpaid wages. And there's actually a law, a judgment that recognizes this. So it's regardless of the status of the individual. They do case management to be able to really work with their clients in terms of engaging with the employer to be able to get back whatever unpaid salaries there are, and run workshops, case management, as well as advocacy. So advocacy is really quite a big part of this work rights program. There's also local integration, looking at really building bridges between the host community and the refugee community, and other various projects that the community outreach program does in partnership with different communities in Malaysia. Then lastly, of course, would be the policy advocacy program. So the policy advocacy program, as the name would suggest, is really looking at engaging with the relevant stakeholders and key decision makers to be able to push for an environment that is human rights affirming, that respects the rights of refugees and upholds the rights of refugees. So we are really looking at not just responding to needs that evolve when the environment evolves, but really looking into introducing the necessary systemic changes in order to make the environment more sustainable for refugees in Malaysia. So everything, all of these programs really tie together cleanly in order to be able to holistically address the lack of protection that refugees face in Malaysia.
You mentioned how there's like refugee community, so I'm guessing they're segregated by country of origin?
They're segregated, yes. They're segregated by, I mean, there's different communities based on countries of origin, but of course within different countries, you would have different ethnic groups as well, who have different languages. And so there are like subgroups as well that exist. So it's not necessary that you'd have, let's say, one entire community just from Myanmar alone. So generally, however, it is based on their country of origin.
So is there like a disproportionate amount of refugees coming from a certain country or like a certain ethnic group?
So you and I think you will notice this in the news a lot, right? So the Rohingya community comes up a lot in the news, particularly when it comes to languages of xenophobia and racism. Like, I mean, it's usually the Rohingya community that usually surfaces in headlines. So in terms of, if we look at the figures, the current figures from the UNHCR, you'd see that the majority of refugees in Malaysia, asylum seekers and refugees in Malaysia, are those who are from Myanmar. And Myanmar has different ethnic groups. It's not just the Rohingya. Although obviously when we compare, when we look at the status of the Rohingya, they are essentially rendered stateless by Myanmar. So in terms of the Myanmar group, the largest number, the largest community within the Myanmar group are in fact the Rohingya community. But that's not to take away that there are also other community groups that exist as well. So that would be by far the largest. And I think we've also got to take into consideration the geographical location as well. Myanmar is quite proximate. And that may also be one of the reasons for why there's such a large number of refugees from Myanmar here.
So have you worked with clients like one-on-one, like actually firsthand working with clients?
Yes. So actually under the legal services program, our main focus is on individualized legal assistance. So it's interesting. If you put the legal services program and the community outreach program, both programs actually have elements of both individual service, individual level service, and community engagement. I mentioned a bit about the community outreach program because I spoke a lot about like running workshops, engaging and encouraging refugee leadership. But I also spoke about, you know, the work rights program that really runs individual case management. So if we bring it back to the legal services program that I'm responsible for, our main focus is really on providing that individualized legal assistance. We have an element of community engagement as well. So we run workshops as well, and we engage with community leaders to ensure that the workshops that we run are relevant. It does not make sense to just kind of like swoop in to a community space, run a workshop, and then, you know, helicopter out. And then after that, you know, leave it at that. That's really not the way that we work. And so the idea is to engage with community leaders to be able to know the type of topics that would be relevant that their community members would want to listen to. So, but our primary work really is about one-on-one and one-to-one. That's really the main focus of our work at Legal Services.
Would you mind sharing any stories you have or experiences that might have shaped you while doing this work?
Well, that's a big question. I guess, so I've worked in the refugee space since end of 2014. It's been, almost 10 years now. I can't pinpoint to any one story that really shaped me. I think it's just been a culmination of different stories. And every story that you hear and or every client that you interact with leaves an imprint on me. So I don't have specifics for you, unfortunately, Victor, but it is, I can tell you that it is really by luck that we are born as free Malaysians, and everyday people are born in a situation where they are displaced against their choice and their will. Really nothing much separates us. And I think that's one of the key takeaways that I usually have with every interaction with different clients that I have. Sometimes it boggles the mind how similar we are and yet how different the circumstances have been for us, and how unfair and how unjust it is that that refugees in Malaysia are facing the kind of environments that they are. So, you know, I remain thankful, but also very keenly aware that this may be us one day. I mean, God forbid that one day Malaysia then, you know, devolves into a situation of conflict or violence. If we look to the recent example of Sudan, for example, where intense fighting broke out on 15th April, and now you have a large number of Sudanese really finding themselves in this precarious situation overnight, and finding different ways to be able to leave the country safely, that, you know, it really boggles the mind. And so I don't have specifics. I will say that every story is different, and every story does change me.
So I grew up with a lot of kids, and all the kids I grew up with, I want to be fireman, I want to be a policeman. How did you end up being a civil rights refugee advocate?
Oh, okay. So growing up, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, so that was quite easy. And after I completed my law degree, I think then it became a question of whether or not I wanted to go into academia or start my chambering. And the thing is, just in terms of human rights, that has always been a passion. I've always been interested in international news and international affairs since I was a child. I've followed news on Palestine since I was 14, and then after that followed the war on Iraq in 2003 when that broke out, and then after that the invasion of Afghanistan in 2002. So it's been really a long process, and so I knew that I wanted to be involved in human rights in any capacity. So after reading law, I did consider joining academia, but ultimately that idea was shot down because I was advised, very strongly advised, to do my chambering at the very least, get called to the bar, and at least, you know, be admitted as an advocate and solicitor, and then I can decide what I wanted to do. So I did all that and found myself sucked into practice in a rather different area, which was in commercial law and construction law, actually, before moving to general litigation. I will say that I don't regret it one bit. It really did shape the way I approached work. It shaped the ethics within which I approach work in the years to come. And so I think it was just a natural progression after I eventually decided to leave practice. It was really about what are the options available for me to be able to really forward the issues that I felt strongly about. And so looking at conflict, obviously related to that would be the people affected by the conflict, which I've always felt very, very strongly about. And so that then led me to the UNHCR, which happened coincidentally to have an opening at that time in their protection unit that looked at legal issues. So, and it's really just been, it's just been that since then.
How did your peers or even family members react from you taking the step from civil litigator to working with refugees?
I think there was definitely befuddlement. I think leaving practice in and of itself is not particularly unheard of. You do hear of people leaving practice after a while, so that wasn't, you know, that wasn't strange. But I think particularly my parents, I think they just had a lot of questions as to where what exactly is it that I do, where exactly would this position lead me, and then of course in terms of like career progression, that was definitely a question mark. And it's really, yeah, I would say that's what my family members reacted. I think for my peers, they were a bit puzzled, but overall supportive, because I think particularly for peers who have been with me for a very long time, they know what my areas of interest are. So it wasn't, I don't think it came as a particular surprise to them.
So let's say you were able to go back to law school, what would you have done differently?
What would I have done differently in law school?
Other than applying for UM, but either way.
No, I'm very happy. I have absolutely no regrets studying at UIA, but UIM obviously has a very good program as well. No, I think what would I have done differently? I don't think there's anything I would have done differently. I think those 4 years reading law, I have absolutely no regrets in choosing the course that I did, and you know, almost all the subjects I studied clicked for me. I mean, obviously, with the exception of certain subjects, which to this day I'm very glad I'm not working in. But yes, there. I didn't say that. You did. So yes. So no, I don't think I would have done anything differently. Probably, I would have. I think the only thing I would have done differently is maybe made a bit more time for co-curricular activities. I think I kept my head in the books for quite a bit during that time. That would have been one thing that would have been good. But other than that, I don't think there's anything I would have changed. It was an interesting time. It was the early 2000s, kind of, in a way, revealing my age here. But, and it was really, you know, it was really an interesting time to study law and just kind of like witness the changes, both globally and on the national level as well.
So you've been in the industry for over 10 years. Have you seen like any major changes or attitudes, the way you approach working when you first started and now? like work in terms of like work-life balance, or whether which one we should prioritize?
I think I just approach it with without my rose-tinted glasses. I think when I first came in, I was very, well, it was unfamiliar. So you will remember that when I first started work, I was thrusted into the world of legal practice. And then that was all that I knew before eventually leaving. And then after that, joining an international organization. And, you know, that was really new for me. And I think when I first joined, it was really about wanting to get things right, because knowing that ultimately the clients, I mean, the so-called quote-unquote clients that I was working with and for are not, you know, corporate clients with deep pockets. There was actually a real life implication if I didn't perform well. So and at that time, I was, you know, it was also, you know, a period of being really gung-ho about really forwarding certain issues, ensuring that really wanting to change the environment, as it were, at that particular time. I wouldn't say that drive has decreased over the years, but I think one approach that has definitely changed is that at the beginning, I really stretched myself thin. I did everything I could, or everything I thought I could at that particular time, just really wanting to make sure that I met every need of every individual that I was responsible for. And now, about more than 10 years later, I wouldn't say that has necessarily changed, but I think there is also a recognition that there are limitations to what any person can do, and knowing when it is that I would need to stop. When is it where, just really recognizing that boundaries are important. Recognizing that limitations exist not because of myself, but because of this, you know, hostile environment and the lack of protection spaces. Acknowledging it, and acknowledging it does not mean accepting it. And then after that, taking it on from there. So that would be, I would say, my main change, like really recognizing that there are limitations to what I can do. And I'm not a superwoman. And at the end of the day, just knowing when it is that I would need to stop. I will say that, unfortunately, I still have a problem with this. I sometimes still take on a lot more than I'm able to. But again, I think it really just boils down to the subject matter, because we're talking about people's lives, about their human rights, about their ability to be able to live safely with dignity. And so it becomes quite difficult to kind of like say, nope, that's it. That's enough. I'm done. So, yeah.
Speaking about performance, I think this goes across any industry or any occupation you're doing. Like when you don't perform, like does that affect you, like personally, or like when let's say an appeal case doesn't go through to the UNHCR, right, and they're no longer and they can't appeal anymore to become a refugee, does that affect you?
It does, but I think there is two separate things, right? There's performance in the sense that how satisfied are you with with your work performance, and then there's like, you know, then there, so there's like there's input, and then there's the results, right? And then so the results is quite separate, and I don't think the results is reflective of the any individual's performance. So in terms of performance is important for me. But I don't think it's necessarily the word performance. I just think it's in terms of like work ethic. I think it's incredibly important to recognize, my responsibilities and how I'm held accountable. And it's not about being held accountable by any external party, but holding yourself accountable, I think, is incredibly important. I will say this is quite separate from the results itself. If I've known that, you know, we've given everything for a particular case, and ultimately at the end of the day, the results are still negative, I wouldn't, you know, of course the implication is quite different for the client that I've that we've worked for, that we've provided services for. There's definitely a feeling of disappointment, frustration there. But if I know that we've given it our all, then, you know, that disappointment and frustration wouldn't, you know, would just be limited to just the results itself and not necessarily to the performance. to the work that was done into putting their case before the UNHCR.
Would you also apply that mindset whereby, let's say, like, I'm a struggling student where I'm performing my very well, my very level best, and I'm still not getting the results that I wanted? It was just a tangent that I thought of.
Okay. All right. Okay. Wait, can you rephrase that question? Because I want to make sure that I understand you correctly.
I'm trying my best and I'm still not performing.
Right. Okay. I think in terms of results, people say work hard, work smart, not work hard. So there's and different people have different strategies when it comes to let's say studying, right? So I think the idea is this: if you're giving it your level best and the results are still not satisfactory, right? Then I think it's a matter of like looking at your strategy. First of all, it's knowing that you're doing everything that you can and the results are still not, you know, up to par. Like you're not happy with where you are. If you keep on doing the same thing over and over again with the same results, it's like people say, if you do the same things with no results, it's like it's a work of a crazy person, right? So then it's a matter of like reevaluating your strategy and seeing like, okay, what needs to change and in order to get the results that you want. Now, let's say that you've done everything that you can there as well. Then I think at the end of the day, you'd need to ask yourself, okay, how much are these results reflective of my, you know, my ability to, let's say, understand this subject? Because results are born out of what, coursework, I suppose, as well as exams or a hybrid of both. And this assessment works in the academic setting, but it's not necessarily reflective of an individual's overall understanding of a subject or skills. So usually people make reference to the late Karpal Singh, that he had graduated with I think normal results. Like it wasn't particularly it wasn't like he graduated with flying colors, and yet we see what giant he was and what impact he made in the legal industry. So I would basically temper it by saying that, okay, let's see what I need to change in my strategy. If that doesn't work as well, then knowing that you've really just given it your all in every aspect, and then after that, knowing that the results are not 100% reflective of any person's understanding of the topic or subject.
Thank you so much for your advice. And I think that would come to the conclusion of our podcast for today. Once again, thank you, Ms. Lumna, for coming. And thank you also to Asylum Access for allowing us to do this.
Thank you so much.